Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ezekiel chapter 22, which I will call Israel's Shedding of Blood. Now, to give you a heads up on this chapter, in the 31 verses, the term bloodshed, shed blood, or shedding blood comes up over and over again, so we get an idea of the theme of the chapter. I'll point these out to you as we go through. When was the prophecy given to Ezekiel? Well, it was given in the same year as the previous chapter, chapter 21. This is according to Precept Austin. I'll take their word for it. In a previous chapter, we saw that a series of prophecies had been given in the seventh year since the capture of Jehoiachin and the establishment of Zedekiah as king in Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. That happened in 597, so if this is the seventh year, 597 minus 7 is 590, and so to be safe, we go back and ahead a year, and we end up with a date range of somewhere between 591 and 589 is when this prophecy is given. And of course, the Babylonian siege was 588, begun and finished in 586. So we're talking about just a year or two before the Babylonians are coming. And that gives us context, and sometimes a dramatic context, of what is about to happen. Chapters 8 through 19 were given a year earlier, between 592 and 590. So you see, the whole first part of the book of Ezekiel was given in a very short time period. So we begin now. I'll read verses 1 through 5. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, would you judge her? Would you judge this city of bloodshed? That's Jerusalem. Then confront her with all her detestable practices and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O city that brings on herself doom by shedding blood in her midst and defiles herself by making idols, you have become guilty because of the blood you have shed and have become defiled by the idols you have made. You have brought your days to a close, and the end of your years has come. Therefore, I will make you an object of scorn to the nations and a laughingstock to all the countries. Those who are near and those who are far away will mock you, O infamous city full of turmoil. Now, we're used to God calling Jerusalem and Judah and Israel idolatrous, and we'll see that again in this chapter, but now we'll see the emphasis put upon the murders that were done in Jerusalem. Both idolatry and bloodshed are mentioned in this chapter, but as I said, bloodshed is mentioned prominently, and we tend to forget that. We tend to think of the idolatry, but also actual murders were being done. In verse 2, God calls the city of bloodshed. That was referring to all the prophets who had been killed in Jerusalem. Remember, Jesus said, all the prophets who have been killed in this city, from Abel to Zechariah. So Ezekiel is bid by the Lord to confront Jerusalem with all her detestable practices and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Now, sovereign Lord is what God calls himself all the way through the book of Ezekiel. Sovereign, of course, means he's in charge of who's going to be ruling, what empire is going to be on top, and what empire is going down. And he's also sovereign enough where he can judge his chosen people and destroy their nation, while at the same time preserving a remnant so his covenant promises will be kept inviolate. And speaking of titles, in verse 2, God calls Ezekiel son of man, and as I've said many times before, Ezekiel is called this in just about every chapter that we go through here so far. I assume it will continue as we go. There are two theories as to why Ezekiel was called son of man. Theory number one is that son of man indicates that Ezekiel had the characteristics of a man, and a man is fallible and weak. He puts his pants on one leg at a time. Therefore, Ezekiel, even though you are getting great prophecies from the throne room of God, do not get arrogant. Be humble. That's theory number one. I think theory number two is better. God is creating a type of Jesus, because Jesus called himself the Son of Man all the way through the Gospels. Jesus took the term from the book of Daniel. The Son of Man went up to the Ancient of Days. Daniel was obviously speaking of the Messiah, and so Jesus took that term to show that he was the Messiah. And the theory goes that Ezekiel was called Son of Man by God so that God could make Ezekiel a living type of the anti-type Jesus, because Ezekiel is preaching to the rebellious house of Israel. Ezekiel is preaching about a temple that's about to be burnt down, which it was in 586, And Jesus was preaching against the rebellious house of Israel, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he was prophesying about a temple that was about to be destroyed, the temple in Jerusalem, which was destroyed in AD 70, as Jesus predicted in the Olivet Discourse. God repeats his term, city of bloodshed, in verse 3 when he says, O city that brings on herself doom by shedding blood. John Gill says that this shedding blood was mainly through judicial murders. I think that's probably right. The big shots, you don't need to go out and stab somebody. You just get them before the courts. Oh, you're guilty of this. Bang. Down you go. And verse 3 also mentions that Israel has defiled herself by making idols. So idolatry is mentioned in this chapter. In fact, it's going to be mentioned in graphic detail later on. So we have bloodshed and idolatry competing as the worst aspects of the city of Jerusalem. Verse 4, you, Jerusalem, have become guilty because of the blood you have shed and because you have become defiled by the idols you have made. There it is, bloodshed and idols. You have brought your days to a close and the end of your years has come. That would be in 586 when the Babylonians burn your city to the ground. Therefore, I will make you an object of scorn to the nations. That's because everybody's going to be laughing at Jerusalem. Ha, 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 look at what happened to you. And you're going to be a laughingstock for all the countries around. Those who are near and those who are far away will mock you. Everybody's going to mock you, O infamous city. The countries who were near to Israel and who hated Israel, typically, almost always, the Edomites to the south of the Dead Sea, the Philistines to the southwest of Jerusalem in the Promised Land, the Moabites to the east of the Dead Sea, the Ammonites to the east of the Jordan River, Aram to the north and northeast of Israel. Aram is Syria. All of these places were near and would hate Israel, and those who were far away would hate Israel too. That would be the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, Medes and Persians, to the east of the Tigris River, the Babylonians to the west of the Tigris River in the Mesopotamian Valley. We go now to Ezekiel 22, verses 6 through 12. Yahweh continues, see how each of the princes of Israel who are in you uses his power to shed blood. There it is again. In you they have treated father and mother with contempt. In you they have oppressed the alien and mistreated the fatherless and the widow. You have despised my holy things and desecrated my Sabbaths. In you are slanderous men bent on, here it is again, shedding blood. In you are those who eat at the mountain shrines and commit lewd acts. This is idolatry. In you are those who dishonor their father's bed. Now we got some just plain old immorality thrown in addition to shedding blood and committing idolatry. In you, Jerusalem, are those who violate women during their period when they are ceremonially unclean. In you, one man commits a detestable offense with his neighbor's wife. Another shamefully defiles his daughter-in-law. And another violates his sister, his own father's daughter. In you, men accept bribes to shed blood. You take usury and an interest. NIV has excessive interest. I don't like that. We'll just say interest. You take usury. You take usury and interest and make unjust gain from your neighbors by extortion. And you have forgotten me, declares the sovereign Lord. In verse 7, God tells Jerusalem that they have oppressed the alien. That's the proselyte to the Jewish faith. KJV has stranger. Basically, it means legally what we call an alien today. Someone who is not a native resident and citizen. They might be in Israel to visit or maybe to do business or whatever, but the law was supposed to apply for them too. They were not supposed to be oppressed. In fact, it's mentioned many, many times in the law, you treat the alien right. You treat them kindly. You don't oppress them, but the Jews in Jerusalem did oppress them, and they mistreated the fatherless and the widow. In other words, the orphans and widows. Widows and orphans. Special category in the law. As an old law professor of mine said one time, the law needs to protect the weak. The Old Testament law had lots to say about taking care of widows and orphans, and the Jews had done nothing to do that. You have despised my holy things. That would include the temple, the priests, the sacrifices, the whole temple ritual that was set up by God. They despised those things, probably not carrying out the temple procedures properly. You've desecrated my Sabbaths. That would be by doing work on the Sabbath. In you, Jerusalem, are slanderous men bent on shedding blood. Why connect slander with shedding blood? Probably because their lies, their slanderous lies, led to the shedding of blood. If slander is believed, it makes people angry enough to kill the slandered one. In you are those who eat at the mountain shrines and commit lewd acts. That's talking about acts of adultery. That's not talking about, or is it talking about, those who commit adultery and fornication and incest? I don't know. When you connect shrines and lewd acts, it makes me think of spiritual sins, which are metaphorically represented by physical sins, but it could be. I'm sure that the Jews were doing incest and adultery and fornication. It wouldn't surprise me. Besides, we're going to get some physical acts coming up, in which there's no doubt they were doing that. Verse 10, in you, Jerusalem, are those who dishonor their father's bed. Now, let me give you another translation for that. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, men within you have sexual intercourse with their father's wife. Now, that sounds like your mother, but it's not. It's a stepmother or a concubine of a father, as the Cambridge commentator says. At least they weren't having incest with their blood mother. That's probably even beyond the Jerusalemites. But they were committing incest with their stepmothers or their father's concubine. That was a no-no in the law, Leviticus 18, 6-8. You are not to come near any close relative for sexual intercourse. I am Yahweh. You are not to shame your father by having sex with your mother. She is your mother. You must not have sexual intercourse with her. You are not to have sex with your father's wife. It will shame your father. And because that phrase used is father's wife, that's where you get the idea, is stepmother, not blood mother, father's wife. You wouldn't call your mother your father's wife. Well, that's bad, but verse 10 goes on, in you, Jerusalem, are those who violate women during their period. John Gill says this violation consisted of rape, raping a woman during her menstrual period, which made it a double crime. Well, now that's interesting. I don't think anybody today would look at a rape case and say, oh, that's terrible, he raped her during her period, because that would be such a minor thing, the time of the rape compared to the rape itself. Well, but back under the Mosaic law, having sex with a menstruating wife was considered unclean because of the blood. The whole purpose of the law is to protect the sanctity of blood, because blood is that where the life is, and life had to be given for the sins of the people, capital punishment, if you will, ritually. Life is in the blood, and the blood had to be sprinkled, and so you don't mess with blood in the Old Testament law. And when you have sex with a wife who is menstruating, there's blood, and so the law prohibits it. We read that in Leviticus 15, verse 24. If a man sleeps with her, that's his wife, and blood from her menstruation gets on him, he will be unclean for 7 days, and every bed he lies on will become unclean. It was a minor penalty, unclean for 7 days. You couldn't go to the temple. But still, it was a violation, and it was mentioned here. Now, it might be that the man didn't rape the menstruating woman, but that he just had sex with her. In fact, God's Word's translation has this, they have sex with women when the women are having their periods and are unclean. Well, that would take care of the objection that, why in the world would God mention rape during a menstruation? Why would he just not say rape is bad, because the menstruating part is such a minor thing? Why would you even put that in there? So, in order to avoid that opinion, we can just take the God's Word translation and say that these men are having sex with women during their period, probably voluntarily. Probably the women are doing it. They're probably committing adultery. Could even be one's wife, because you weren't supposed to have sex with your wife when it was her period. Verse 11, in you, one man commits a detestable offense with his neighbor's wife. That detestable offense would be adultery. It's not detestable too much anymore because everybody's doing it in America. At least they don't think it's detestable, but it is. Leads to all kinds of problems. Shootings, revenge killings, broken hearts, broken families. In verse 11, Yahweh continues, another shamefully defiles his daughter-in-law. That's his son's wife, has sex with his son's wife. Another violates his sister. That would be his half-sister, not his blood sister. Sister from a different parent. His own father's daughter, that again would be a stepsister. The father would have blood mother, and then the father would have stepmother, and stepmother would have half-sister. That was forbidden in the law, by the way. You weren't supposed to do that. We again have the word violates. If another violates his sister, does that mean just have sex with or rape? Gil thinks it's rape, but it was wrong just to have sex voluntarily with a half-sister. Verse 12, and you men accept bribes to shed blood. There's shedding blood again. What does a bribe have to do with shedding blood? Well, a couple of options here. The bribe could be money given to judges in return for judicial murder. In other words, judge, find this innocent man guilty so you can capitally stone him to death. Or maybe the money was given to witnesses. I'll pay you if you will testify that this guy raped my daughter and murdered my son, even though you didn't really see it happen. And so such a victim of a tainted judicial process would be killed, and thus his blood would be shed. And verse 12, God condemns those who take usury. You are not allowed to take interest on a charitable loan. A charity loan was when you lent money to someone who had undergone a serious dislocation in his life, like a flood, like a house fire, whatever, earthquake, sickness. You're not supposed to take usury. But the NIV has, you're not supposed to take excessive interest. Most of the other translations have interest. You're not supposed to take interest. Why? Because you're not supposed to take interest on a charity loan. That leaves open a business loan. Of course, it was all right to take money on a business loan. The problem I have with the NIV translation, and it's the only translation that I know that uses excessive interest in its translation, the NIV translation makes it sound like there's a limit on the amount of interest a creditor can charge. Well, the problem is how do you know what's excessive or not? What's the term of the loan? What's the risk of the loan if it's a business loan? What is the supply of funds in the relevant money market or the relevant financial market? To use modern terms, there's a lot of things that go into interest rates. What's the inflation rate? So I think the NIV translation is way off kilter here. So basically, these are people that are taking advantage of people who've had misfortunes and not legally lending them the principal and getting the principal back without interest. You have forgotten me, declares the sovereign Lord. Well, that's an understatement. We go now to Ezekiel chapter 22, verses 13 through 22. Yahweh continues, I will surely strike my hands together at the unjust gain you have made and at the blood you have shed in your midst. There's bloodshed again. Will your courage endure or your hands be strong in the day I deal with you? I, the Lord, have spoken. That's a rhetorical question. The answer is no, your courage will not endure and your hands will not be strong. I, the Lord, have spoken and I will do it. I will disperse you among the nations and scatter you through the countries, and I will put an end to your uncleanness. When you have been defiled in the eyes of the nations, you will know that I am the Lord. Then the word of the Lord came to me. Now Ezekiel is speaking in verse 17. The word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel. Son of man, the house of Israel has become dross to me. All of them are the copper, tin, iron, and lead left inside a furnace. They are but the dross of silver. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Because you have all become dross, I will gather you into Jerusalem, as men gather silver, copper, iron, lead, and tin into a furnace to melt it with a fiery blast, so will I gather you in my anger and my wrath and put you inside the city and melt you. Talking about 586 when the Babylonians come. I will gather you and I will blow on you with my fiery wrath, and you will be melted inside her. As silver is melted in a furnace, so you will be melted inside her, and you will know that I, the Lord, have poured out my wrath upon you. Well, that's not too hard to interpret, is it not? Verse 13, God says, I will surely strike my hands together. Why? In amazement at what's going on? I don't think so. I think it's indignation at what's going on. The Bible in Basic English translation, in fact, says that. See then, I've made my hands come together in wrath against your taking of goods by force and against the blood which has been flowing in you. My hands come together in wrath. Now, the in wrath, I'm sure, is a translator's interpretation. I didn't see the in wrath in other translations, but I think that's what it means. So God's going to strike his hands. Okay, I've had it with you guys. Your courage will not endure. I've spoken. I will do it. Verse 15, I will disperse you among the nations. That happened in 586 during the captivity to Babylon. I will scatter you through the countries. I will put an end to your uncleanness. Notice how the judgment refines, because now the people who are refined are no longer unclean. They're clean after the scattering. That's the whole purpose of this judgment. It was for punishment, yes, but it was also for restoration. Verse 16, when you have been defiled in the eyes of the nations, you will know that I am the Lord. Now, there's a translation issue here. The NIV margin has, when I have allotted you your inheritance, you will know that I am the Lord. That would, I guess, mean when they come back and are restored. But I don't think that's what it's talking about. The whole context here is talking about judgment. It could be the term is used in sort of an ironic sense. Your inheritance is to be defiled, scattered, dispersed, melted. We'll take it as defiled when you've been defiled in the eyes of the nations. And that, of course, would refer to their pink burn up, I'm sure. Then the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel in verse 17 and 18. God says, Son of man, the house of Israel has become dross. Now, dross is the leftover product of a refining furnace. When you put silver and gold in there, all the other impure metals come out of the silver and gold. They boil out. Copper, tin, iron, and lead are the four impure metals that are mentioned. So the Israelites were silver at one time, but not anymore. They got a lot of impurities in them. They've all become dross in verse 19. That's the princes as well as the common people. All of them have become dross. And therefore, I will gather you into Jerusalem. Now, the people thought they were being safe in Jerusalem behind those walls. Actually, God is bringing them there so that they could be destroyed, which happened in 586. Verse 20, as men gather silver, copper, iron, lead, and tin into a furnace to melt it. Now, that's referring to the refining process when men put into a furnace those metals, silver, copper, iron, lead, and tin. They put the metals into the furnace and melt the metals with the silver. And I don't understand how that works because I am not a metallurgist, but the import of the metaphor is quite clear. God is going to take the Israelites, put them into the furnace of Jerusalem and turn up the heat and melt them, blow on them with his fiery wrath. Verse 22, as silver is melted, so you will know that I have poured out my wrath upon you when you get melted. We go now to Ezekiel 22, verses 23 through 29. Ezekiel is speaking now, and he says, again, the word of the Lord came to me. And here's the word of the Lord. Yahweh is speaking now, starting in verse 24. Son of man, say to the land, you are a land that has had no rain or showers in the day of wrath. There is a conspiracy of her princes within her like a roaring lion tearing its prey. They devour people, take treasures and precious things, and make many widows within her. Her priests do violence to my law and profane my holy things. They do not distinguish between the holy and the common. They teach that there is no difference between the unclean and the clean, and they shut their eyes to the keeping of my Sabbaths, so that I am profaned among them. Her officials within her are like wolves tearing their prey. They shed blood, there's that phrase again, shedding blood. They kill people to make unjust gain. Her prophets whitewash these deeds for them by false visions and lying divinations. They say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, when the Lord has not spoken. The people of the land practice extortion and commit robbery. They oppress the poor and needy and mistreat the alien, denying them justice. That sounds awful lot like America, doesn't it? Not. Except we don't have priests anymore. The sexual sins we sure got. Now, in verse 24, we have a translation issue. God tells Ezekiel to say to the land, you are a land that has no rain. Other translations have it this way. Holman Christian Study Bible. Son of man, say to her, you are a land that has not been cleansed, that has not received rain in the day of indignation. The New American Bible has, son of man, say to her, you are a land unrained on, that is not rained on at the time of my fury. At the time of my fury. Now the latter, a land unrained on, is followed in the Bible in Basic English in God's Word translation. And the other option, you're a land that has not been cleansed, is followed by the ASV, the Darby, the KJV, and the NASB translations. So which is it? Here's what Charles Ellicott says. There is much difference of opinion as to the meaning of the clause that is not cleansed. The most probable view is that it speaks of the land as neglected and uncared for, the stones not gathered up and the weeds allowed to grow. It has had neither human care nor has it received the divine blessing of rain. Well, some translations just say it hasn't been rained on, just repeats it, and some translations say it hasn't been cleansed, the land has not been cleansed, and it also has not received rain. It's a minor point. That's what happens when there's wrath. No rain, because rain means food. And of course, no rain was part of the curses. Deuteronomy 28, 29, the curses of the law. We have another translation issue in verse 25. In the NIV, verse 25 says, there is a conspiracy of her princes to tear people up, devour people, take treasures, steal precious things, kill men, leaving widows behind, and so forth. A conspiracy of princes. Other translations have a conspiracy of prophets. In fact, the majority, at least of my translations that I consult, have prophets. The ASV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, the Darby Translation, the King James, the New American Standard Bible, and Young's Literal Translations all have prophets. The Darby Note says it's princes. God's Word, the New American Bible, has princes, as does the NIV. I guess that the reason the translators who chose princes over prophets did so because it makes more sense that princes would be doing all these things, tearing up people, devouring people, stealing treasures. If it's prophets, that's not the sort of thing that prophets usually do. So let's just assume it's princes, and by doing that, we now can see how every order of society is totally immersed in sin. Princes are mentioned as horrible sinners in verse 25, priests are mentioned in verse 26, prophets are mentioned in verse 28, and people are mentioned in verse 29, that's everybody else, as being horrible sinners. We'll go through them one by one. We've already said that the princes or the prophets tear their prey, they devour people, they take treasures and precious things, they're thieves, in other words, and they make many widows. Well, how can a prince make a widow? Well, they could, of course, hire somebody to kill a man, or they could judicially murder him. What if it's a prophet, though? How can a prophet make a widow out of somebody? Well, option number one, a prophet could persecute the husband to death for not believing their false prophecies. Option number two, this is from Benson, the false prophet could persuade husbands to hold out the siege, fight the Babylonians under a notion of deliverance. In other words, God is saying, we're going to beat the Babylonians, and then they don't beat the Babylonians, and then they get killed, thus making widows of their wives. That's Benson's solution. That makes sense to me. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown backs up Benson's idea by saying that these false prophecies are given concerning the war with Babylon, in which the husbands fell. In other words, fight. Fight the Babylonians. You'll win. No, they won't win. They'll get killed. Now, the prophets are definitely mentioned in verse 28, not optionally. We'll get to them in just a minute, but first, in verse 26, we'll look at the priest of Jerusalem. They do violence to my law, and notice what they do is they do not distinguish the clean and the unclean. That's what the whole book of Leviticus is about. Clean and unclean, clean and unclean. That was their job, to teach people the sacred and the profane. They didn't keep the Sabbaths. That was a capital offense, not to keep the Sabbaths. Well, they're all going to die in 586. Verse 27, the officials, that's the civil officials now. That sounds like the princes. They're like wolves. They tear their prey. They shed blood. They kill people. Verse 28, now the prophets are condemned. These are, of course, false prophets. They whitewash the deeds of the princes who are killing people. It's okay. They deserved it. The false prophets tell the officials that their judicial robbery and murder is sanctioned by God. They could tell other people, but they could tell the murderers themselves, oh, you're an official of Jerusalem, of Israel, of Judah. You're doing your job. Kill that person who doesn't listen to you. We go now to Ezekiel 22, verses 30 through 31. I looked for a man among them, this is God speaking, I looked for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land, so I would not have to destroy it. But I found none. So I will pour out my wrath on them and consume them with my fiery anger, bringing down on their own heads all they have done, declares the Sovereign Lord. Now God is looking for a righteous man, a stand-in-the-gapper, a builder-up of a wall, the wall being the wall that protects Jerusalem, and if there's a gap in the wall, he fills the gap in so the bad guys can't come in. And this is a spiritual metaphor, of course. But he couldn't find anybody. Now, you might say, well, there were good people in Jerusalem. Jeremiah and Baruch were there. But I think that overlooks the point is that Jeremiah and Baruch had no clout. They were in jail half the time in a cistern or in the prison of the gatehouse of the guard. So there are no people there in Jerusalem who will stand up to defend against the Babylonians. And, of course, the way they would defend against the Babylonians is they would quit shedding blood. They would quit giving false prophecies. They would quit committing sexual immorality. Now, these righteous men that God can't find, they would stand in the gap. You've heard that expression before if you've been a Christian for very long, because Christians, at least evangelical Protestant Christians, love to quote that all the time. Are you standing in the gap? Well, that's an appropriate use of the metaphor, I think, because that's exactly what God is looking for, people who will stand in the gap to defend against the enemy. So I think that's reasonable. Now, that gap represented the gap that sin had made. Who's going through that gap? There's a couple of different ways you could look at that. The Babylonians are going to be coming through the gap and destroying Jerusalem, and I think that's what it's referring to. Another option is the Lord himself entering as a man of war to destroy the transgressors. I don't think that's what it means. Adam Clark says it's a gap in the moral state of the people. I don't think that's what it means either. I think it's referring to the fact that the nation of Judah is open to attack because its walls are down, and that's because of their immorality. And through that gap, enemies are going to come, namely the Babylonians, and they're going to burn the city to the ground. Unless you repent, which of course they didn't, and the city was burnt to the ground. So ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with Ezekiel 22, and we are now prepared to go in our next audio to Ezekiel 23, which I will call Oholah and Oholibah. Interesting title. I hope you stay with me as we discuss that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.